Welcome to everybody. I'm delighted that you are here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president of CSIS. I spent the night flying back from San Francisco to get here, so if I say something really stupid, it's because I'm jet lagged rather than that I don't know what I'm talking about. At least today I have an excuse. So. I'm really delighted that we could have this session. Thank you all for coming. I especially want to say thank you and praise to the so-called Gang of Five. I told them I remembered a time when that used to be kind of a shorthand for bad people in China. Remember, you know? And now all of a sudden it's a moniker for some of the best minds that we have in defense intellectual circles. And we're really proud and glad to have you with us. When Klaus Naumann first spoke to me about this, I thought this is the continuing reason why it's worth investing in alliances. This is a when you think I'm currently reading a book on this flight back. I started reading it's a book called Ike, you know, which is a history of Eisenhower, and the first three chapters are about World War II. And to think, you know, it was all about the battles, you know, that were going on between the Americans and the Brits and the French. And we had all these incredible battles about who was going to be in charge and what priorities would be set, how we would, et cetera. And to think what's happened in a span of 60 years, 50 years, that an institution was created that brought people together that in history never would have been brought together in any other way, to think collectively about a problem that we all share. None of us can solve the problem on our own, and all of us working together have a shot at it, a good chance to solve it. And that's the product of an investment, a long-time investment in alliance. And these five individuals that were the authors of this, I think somebody called it a pamphlet. I'm not sure how that term came. It is a remarkable testament to, I think, the value, the importance of this alliance. Now the question is does this alliance have a future? And, you know, to be honest, there's a lot of questioning about that in Washington. It's, in some ways, we're like an old married couple that, you know, that goes to a restaurant and sits all night and never talks to each other. You know, you've seen them. And because we know each other so well, we've gotten comfortable and old together, and we don't talk to each other anymore. And for the last several years, you know, it's been like this old married couple. This study, I think, is so important because, you know, five old bulls, you know, from this alliance got together to think positively about the future. This is not a book of nostalgia. This is a book that's looking forward. This is a book that's very fresh. And it's freshly thinking about the challenges that we're going to face together and what we can do about it. And I strongly, strongly commend it to you. And I would like to really congratulate this group for having taken the time to put their personal energy behind this very important effort. This is a young, fresh look at a problem that we're going to have together. And it is, I'm really grateful that they gave us a chance to be a Washington platform for this effort. So thank you all. Thank you for doing that. Now let me turn to Dr. Steve Flanagan. He's really going to start us today, and I'm going to go to the back of the room and sleep quietly while I through his part, and then listen for the rest of it. Thank you all for coming. Steve, please.
Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hamry. And I'm going to, was indicated, we're going to give you the sort of the order of battle today. Seems like the appropriate term of art to our discussion, but actually it's not a battle, but very much a neighborly discussion. And we're so delighted to have with us this morning these five former chiefs of general staff, who are not only do they embody the endurability and the strength of the transatlantic link, but they're also personal friends over many years of distinguished service. And I'm going to introduce them each very briefly, and as we mentioned, we have copies of the report available outside and hope you'll get them. The Nober Foundation also will, I think they'll be available through them if we are short later. But so let me just welcome. As I said, they are a remarkable group of five serving military officers. They, as Dr. Hamray suggested, they've very much shown that being retired from military service doesn't mean that you're inactive and not very able to make very positive contributions. And I think that I just did a quick calculation, and I guess all totaled, if we looked at their record of just their military service, they represent over 150 years of experience. So I think since we evoked the Chinese as good as the Chinese would, we should very much pay attention to this wisdom of our elders. So let me go down the road. First of all, here then in introducing General Dr. Klaus Naumann, former chief of the Defense Staff in Germany, also former chairman of the Military Committee, and I'm just, of course, mentioning their highest titles and not the many others that they served in. Next, General Henk van den Bremen, former chief of the Defense Staff of the Netherlands. Next, Admiral Jacques Lansade, who was, former former chief of Defense Staff, a former ambassador and former advisor to the President of France. Field Marshal Lord Inge, the former Chief of Defense Staff in the United Kingdom, and last but not least, we're so delighted that General John Shalikashvili, both the former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and NATO Supreme Allied Commander, could join us this morning, sitting at the end of the table there. Now, as you saw in our program, the order is that we will start out, first of all, General van den Bremen will give an overview of the report for about half an hour. We're delighted to be joined for comments on the report by our former U.S. Ambassador to NATO, now a senior a fellow at the RAND Corporation, Ambassador Robert Hunter, who's seated immediately to my right. And then we had hoped to have Dan Feda, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for NATO and European Affairs, but he regrettably was in London the last few days and came down with that terrible bug that has been spreading there. And so, in a sense, sadly, and we hope wish him well, but sadly a reminder of one of the themes of this report, which is how much the transatlantic community is very much linked together these days, and by new kinds of threats, pandemics or other illnesses that can spread very quickly. So, in any event, so we then have ample time for Q&A. We hope about 10:30 to we have such a good group here, we want to leave ample time for discussion, and I'm sure we will have that. So let me turn the floor over now to General van den Bremen, who will give us the overview of this report towards a grand strategy in an uncertain world, renewing the transatlantic partnership. General van den Bremen.
Ladies and gentlemen, very good to see you. Thank you for coming. Thank you, John Hamray, and your team for organizing this in such a brilliant way, and thank you for making me feel so young. I will tell it immediately when I get home tomorrow and tell my wife I became 40. But thank you, and thank you for being here and listen to the essence of our paper. It's also a great honor for us that today present is here the founder of the Nobel Foundation, Paul Bahn. He's not only the founder but also the chairman. And the Nobel Foundation has sponsored us, and the Nobel Foundation deals with global neighborship in a venture philanthropic way. Now, the initial idea to write this paper lays back on September 11, 2001, because most of us were sitting together in a meeting in a kind of aerospace and defense board when the secretary during the meeting came in with the PC and said, "Look what's happening here." And I'm sure, like everybody here, we just gazed at the screen, slowly realizing what was happening. And then John Shelley said the remarkable words, "Listen, the world is changing." and we have to act on that. And then we thought how to act, and you know, when you immediately want to do something, this idea came up to write a paper or a book, which we decided to do. But then some of us got very sick, and it took some time before we took up again this idea, which we did 1.5 years ago, and we completed the paper, especially also in the honor of John Shalikashvili, and especially in the spirit of his real feeling for transatlantic partnership. So it's fantastic, John, that you are here today, and I also would like formally give a lot of credit to his son, Brent, that you took the command of your father to bring him here, and we know how difficult task that was, so well done. In the next half an hour, I can't get wrong some details, so please apologize when sometimes you think, well, this is a little bit too detailed, but we need it for the end to come to a clear vision for you on the proposals we make. As the title does show of the pamphlet, the heart of this paper is about the need for a grand strategy in this globalizing world and the renewing of transatlantic partnership. And we offer ideas on these major items in chapter 3 and chapter 4. And they are, in fact, the centerpieces of our paper. But we first look at global trends and challenges in chapter 1, setting the scene, and then touch in chapter 2 on the abilities and capabilities of the present major institutions, and linking them also to some of our experiences, political resolve, and public awareness. So, to start with, and we touched upon the various challenges and trends, and that puts against the background of a globalizing world. Much of it might be known to you, especially when you're familiar with documents such as the US NSS or publications of institutions like the ISSS. We all agree, to sum that up, that globalization has led to many benefits, but at the same time, it has introduced a strategic environment that is unprecedented in its interlinking complexity and scale. Trends, risks, dangers can't be seen in isolation, and local risks and threats can become global dangers. And threats can be multi-faced and multi-directed, and there will be no predictability. It's clear for us that these threats demand the development of responses that go beyond military capabilities. What is needed is an approach to a strategy that integrates all the instruments, so non-military and military, available to a given nation or institution. And because no nation or institution, to our opinion, can handle these challenges on its own, we need to tackle them through alliances as well. And this integrated and the allied approach is central to our proposals. So after having set the scene, we then ask ourselves in chapter 2, what about our international institutions? Can they deal with these challenges and trends? And do they have the capabilities? And do they interact in the way needed? And what about the political will? And what about the public awareness? And then if we look to the major institutions like the United Nations, European Union, but also through NATO, we regrettably see, despite considerable potential and positive aspects, major shortfalls. Not only in the sense of organization and capabilities, but also in focus, scope, and cooperation with each other. And in our paper, we highlight some of those. And then when we look at the capabilities, we see in general that European nations have inadequate military capabilities, and NATO has inadequate non-military capabilities. Now, on the latter problem, we come back in Chapter 4, and on the first problem, the military capabilities, we would say that we fully endorse the two documents made by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the European Defense Integration and European C4ISR Capabilities and Transatlantic Interoperability. We also touch in Chapter 2 on two major issues we selected, and that is, first, intelligence, and second, sustainability. Especially also sustainability, we think, as a major factor, because sustainability is not a matter of manpower and equipment alone. It also deals with political will and support of society. So on balance, we then conclude that there is a considerable mismatch between the interconnected list of complex challenges and dangers and the international and national abilities and capabilities to respond to them. And we also conclude that there are few security challenges that America, Europe, and or any nation or present institution can address on their own. So what we need is a renewed transatlantic alliance with a comprehensive grand strategy that is integrated both nationally and among international organizations. And we propose such a strategy in Chapter 3. And we call the strategy a strategy for preventive protection. And it's a generic model. It could apply for any nation or any institution. And we give you an idea how such a strategy could look like. And the first thing we did, we took a basis, an aim, and we chose as anchor point the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations and agreed by the majority of world's nations. This responsibility is at the very core of national sovereignty. Based on this fundamental conviction, and on the common belief that democracy, the rule of law, and good governance constitute values that must be preserved, that proposes our idea about a common grand strategy. And as I said, it's a generic one. We also would like to underline that before you think about a strategy, you absolutely need really refined the aim and objectives, the political aim or objectives. What do we want to achieve? The aims of our strategy are to preserve peace, values, free trade and stability, and it seeks as much as possible certainty for the member nations and their citizens. The resolution of crises by peaceful means and the prevention of armed conflict. In doing so, it aims to reduce the reasons for conflict and, should all attempts to find peaceful solutions fail, to defend the member states' territorial integrity and protect their citizens' way of life, including their values and convictions. It's a protective and a proactive strategy, not a reactive one. And the objectives of such a grand strategy could be threefold. We propose the first one as dealing with global challenges through protection against threats, risks, and dangers. And then building security in the allied states, neighborhoods, and their zones of strategic interest. And then working towards a stable international order through multilateral cooperation. Then in our paper, and that's quite an important part, we spell out our principles and elements of such a new modern strategy. I think those are quite interesting. And then we go to the strategy itself and the implication and application of it. And we see, let's start with that, the basis for any strategy, the basis for any strategy, we see the as the credible protection at home. It's a truly indispensable prerequisite of the strategy's implementation. Protection means taking all necessary reactive steps, including proactive measures, when and where needed. And then, at the beginning of a possible crisis, it's essential that there is a clear, what I just also already said, a clear, well-defined political objective, because then a comprehensive concept comprising all phases of strategy implementation must be developed. And these phases include the reducing the causes of conflict, all steps that comprises all steps taken during this first phase, which will aim at a non-coercive elimination of the reasons that could lead to tensions, crisis, or conflict. And basically, it could achieve any or all objectives of the proposed strategy. Then a second phase, we identified proactive crisis management phase. And that's when the first phase fails. Then all the attempts should be aimed at reducing the potential for conflict. And then proactive crisis management will commence. Then the next phase we identified as enforcement. And should all non-coercive instruments be exhausted and no other option be left open, enforcement operations need to be considered, agreed upon, and enacted upon. By the way, in our view, even such an enforcement phase could be done without military operations. Then there's a fourth phase, the post-intervention stabilization phase. Post-intervention stabilization phase is the implementation element that ends a conflict through the restoration of establishment of good governance, the rule of law, and economic as well as democratic build-up. We all agree, we have seen it, it's the most complex and time and resource-consuming phase in the implementation of the strategy. It requires patience, stamina, considerable resources, integrated planning, and the iron will to see the mission through to success. And we see those four phases of strategy implementation as outline that they are a continuum of intertwined, interconnected, integrated, and coordinated actions focused on achieving the aims and objectives of a strategy of preventive protection. It's therefore also a mechanism for good decision making, because each phase should at each moment be interlinked to the other phases. The consequences of implementing such a strategy will concern three areas: actors, procedures, and capabilities. And you will not be surprised after what I have said that if you want to improve and you want to change, that we really have to come up with a substantial agenda for such a change. And then the first question comes in your mind: how do you manage such a change? And for that, you have to decide on a number of basic principles. The first one, you might conclude that after what I've said, you think we would come up with a total new idea and new organizations and new institutions. But that's not so. We opted for a very pragmatic approach, using as much as possible existing building blocks. And our motto is, what has worked well should be strengthened. NATO and the EU and other existing organizations should be refined. If these institutions were improved and able to work together better, then we would have a very significant base already. And of course, central to the refining of those institutions is the part played in the process by America the USA remains Europe's most important, closest, and indispensable ally. And for the USA to play its role as effectively as possible, the transatlantic bargain between European countries, Canada, and their American ally must be renewed. All of America's European allies acknowledge that, and they also acknowledge that their relationship with the USA is indispensable. But in order to convince the United States to enter into a renewed bargain, Europe needs in return to become a truly indispensable partner to the United States, in our opinion. And there is a heavy onus on the Europeans to prove their worth here, not least in improving their own capabilities. In parallel with these steps, the Allies should discuss and eventually decide on a new grand strategy for transatlantic security. Our thoughts on a possible grand strategy could serve as a starting point for such a process, which could and possibly should take place simultaneously in NATO and the European Union. Having thus established a solid foundation, the move towards real management of change can begin. And first and foremost, this will require a directorate in which most allied nations are represented, and such a forum should not be limited to discussion of one set of tools, and it should be effective enough to achieve quick progress. I will come back to this in the end of my presentation. Turning back then to the agenda of change, you will find in the book that we offer quite a lot of ideas on improvement of the United Nations, the OSCE, and the European Union. And we do that in all modesty, and we don't want to be prescriptive. We just want to offer in all modesty ideas. It's worthwhile in this context mentioning that the EU is on its way to change the organization with a new European treaty, but today, for the sake of discussion, we concentrate during this introduction on NATO. And yeah, we see NATO as an organization of particular importance, since it's the only organization that commits the US and Europe in a legally and mutual binding way, and to defend each other collectively. As you know, today's NATO is in the process of military transformation, and it has been seen political adaptation, some of it, but in its core, it's still a political organization to a large degree, which is focused on the Cold War. Today, rapid response is of the essence, and therefore, for example, the outdated and weighty stovepipe systems of specified committees and bottom-up reporting structures need to be seriously reconsidered. And as NATO is involved in operations today, we feel that when we look at the agenda for change for NATO, we should differ in between immediate possible proposals, medium-term proposals, and long-term proposals. Let's first turn to the immediate agenda. First thing we propose is a restructuring of the decision-making process. As a first step, NATO should, in our opinion, abandon the consensus principle at all levels below the NATO Council and just introduce majority voting. The second thing what we propose, and all these proposals have to do with eventually producing more combat power on the ground and give more power to the commanders on the ground. The second thing we have is that only nations that contribute to a mission, that is military force in a military operation, should have the right to say in the process of the operation. We also really would propose a full-fledged review on NATO's intelligence. We also plead for abolition of the system of national caveats because it really limits the flexibility of the operational commanders. And in relation to this, and we know there are limitations to this, we also propose that we should strive as much as possible to operational command instead of operational control when we put forces to the availability of the NATO commander. We also would like to see that the appointment of the operational commander and the representation in the headquarters should reflect the national contributions and the national preparedness to share the risk and the burdens. Then, and this again against the background of creating as much available power as possible, we also would propose to replace the present infrastructure budget for a procurement fund. So a procurement fund where equipment and capabilities can be bought off. Then we also propose that immediately and entirely the system of cost lie where they fall will abandon. And we recommend the establishment of a commonly financed NATO operation budget. Then on the short term and the immediate term, we would also draw your attention to the urgent need for the development of an information strategy. Going then to the midterm agenda for change, we can't go around it, and that is that we feel that we propose a review of the strategic concept of NATO. And we feel that this document is still missing, and because it is missing, it's failing to give a catalyzing function to new ideas, new visions, and consequently new plans. So we suggest that NATO should develop a grand strategy that encompasses much more than the military domain, and we propose the strategy that we spelled out in Chapter 3, as I have touched upon. Simultaneously, we propose that NATO should address its biggest shortfalls at this time, both military and non-military, and as a first step, it should look for an interim remedy of the non-military capabilities, and we propose in this context exploring the option of a Berlin plus in reverse agreement with the EU, or widening the Canadian initiative of a comprehensive approach. And as we know, NATO could also be supported by the paramilitary and police forces of the EU and other soft power instruments. Then a word on enlargement. As you know, NATO has repeatedly said that the doors should always remain open, and we agree with that. On the other hand, NATO has not yet fully recovered from the rapid process of enlargement. And in the course of this, NATO compromises on some of its standards, and we think that NATO should learn lessons of it. So we gave some thoughts on a new concept for enlargement, bearing in mind that NATO must see clarity on its geographical dimension and that NATO must act where its members' security risk is. And we developed the three circle idea, and here we have to apologize because in the book you will see that the text is okay, but the abbreviations about the middle zone, the common security zone, CSZ, have sometimes been mixed up by CSA, so apologies for that. And as last action point for the medium term agenda, we really propose a realistic take stock operation on where NATO stands in the process of transformation today, because we will need that for the next phase. Coming back then to the long term phase, the long term agenda, following on the agreement on the future NATO grand strategy, it will then have to embark on a full review of its capabilities of implementing such a strategy. Such a review must be focused on flexibility, deployability, sustainability, but its point of departure must, above all, be a solid medium to long-term political commitment to implement appropriate forces structures. And we propose to use it as a stepping stone to the development of a generic NATO force structure model. And if possible, this should be done, developing this in close cooperation with the EU. We also see as a quick method of affordable modernization the enhancement of multinational NATO-owned and operated component forces. And also, we ask attention for the need for establishment of disaster relief forces and deployable police and military police components. And above all, the NATO-EU cooperation should be drastically improved. Well, all steps discussed so far aim at enhancing the capabilities of the existing organizations in order to enable the nations in the transatlantic area to cope better with the challenges, risks, and dangers. But our long-time strategic vision is for a zone of common security and collective action from Finland to Alaska, where membership of NATO and the EU has de facto created a zone in which partners such as the US, NATO, and the European Union often have largely identical political interests. They are signatories to quite a few international treaties and agreements that tie them together, but their political coordination and cooperation need to be improved. As we have repeatedly stated, we are convinced that there is no security for Europe without the US, but we also dare to submit that there is no hope for the US to sustain its role as the world's sole superpower without the Europeans as allies. As such, an alliance serves the strategic interest of both sides, the US and the European Union, we propose as a first step towards a new and wider transatlantic bargain, the establishment of a US-EU-NATO steering directorate at the highest political level based on existing treaties and agreements such as the US-EU agreement, the Washington Treaty, and the EU treaties. Its immediate task will be the coordination of common responses in crisis where common interests are in danger. And the point of such a directorate should be to better liaise for the common good, to coordinate who takes the lead on which issue, and to ensure that the three entities support each other. Of course, this could not happen without capabilities. And our agenda for change is not intended to be prescriptive, as I said, nor do we pretend to have covered all the issues that need to be considered. But we do believe, although ambitious, that we are proposing an agenda that is feasible and affordable. And following up what John Hammer has said in the beginning, I would suggest let's start to talk to each other now. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, General, and thanks to all of your colleagues in the infamous Gang of Five for your contributions. We really appreciate that comprehensive look at all of the various elements of transatlantic security architecture, and we look forward to discussing it here with the audience. But before we do that, as John Hamry mentioned and Steve Flanagan mentioned, we're very pleased to have with us today Ambassador Hunter, who's going to offer his thoughts and comments on the report, and then we'll open it up for questions. So, Ambassador?
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and particularly an honor to be here with these five gentlemen who I had the wonderful opportunity to work with more than a decade ago at NATO. They were, as much as anyone, the great spark plug, the inspiration, the idea factory, and the implementers of NATO's great transformation after the Cold War. We're under the leadership of George H.W. Bush with the Europe Whole and Free and at Peace, followed by Bill Clinton. It was possible to consolidate a transformation of NATO, a renewal of the transatlantic relationship, and a reaching out to countries and peoples who had, in some cases, never before had an opportunity to be part of European security most widely defined. Their vision and their capacity served us all extremely well, and their history hasn't yet been written. I just have to pick one bone that I have with John Shelley Cashfield. Soon after I went to NATO, where he was one of the truly outstanding Supreme Allied Commanders of Europe, in order to get away from me, he took a demotion, came to the United States and became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, one of the truly outstanding, if not the most outstanding, chairman of the chiefs that we have had, continuing a partnership with these other gentlemen and with people on the civilian side. So let me just say, to coin a phrase, when they looked at the problems 10 years ago, they responded to them with three words: yes, we can. If anybody's heard those words recently. That's point one. These people have the experience, and they're also change agents, showing the two go together. Secondly, it is remarkable that the people who have come here are not civilians, they're not politicians, they're not diplomats, but they're people with a tremendous experience in the military profession, who also seen their role in the political military profession, and not just warrior diplomats, but people who have looked to the requirements of the future and recognized that a major element of those requirements are what we would call non-military. Third point is that four of the five of these are Europeans. We have a history of so much of the alliance that nothing would happen unless there's American leadership, American initiative. Most of what was done in the 1990s was originally made in Washington. But by the time we finished in the mid-1990s, it was clear that every single ally had played a part. And here we are today, the leadership and inspiration of John Shelley, but these are mostly Europeans speaking to us Americans. Fourth insight is we are, I believe, in this moment of transatlantic history, witnessing a fantastic opportunity for a number of reasons. Number one, we've seen change in governments in Europe, Britain, France, and Germany, all of which have a new inspiration, and not to depreciate the other two, but in particular in France, which is now going through a process which involves an understanding which has to be mutually shared, that the lot of the Europeans, regardless of whatever an institution, the lot of the North Americans, regardless of the institutions, have to be done together, and that the theology of the past has to give way on all sides to the reality of the future. We've also, another thing that has happened, NATO and the transatlantic relationship went through its most difficult period with Iraq. The book is now being closed on that and reopened on an understanding that whatever divided us in that period, we now have to be united, not just in the Middle East, but everywhere. We're moving beyond. Now, I have to say something right away, that in some ways, when they paint a difficult picture, perhaps they were optimists. I think it's going to be even more difficult than they say. The creation of a unified vision, however compelling the items in that first chapter, which puts it as well as I have ever seen. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult because there is no one institution that embodies them all, because there is no one set of leaders. There is no central paradigm that automatically leaps out at us. There's no Soviet Union. Terrorism itself is an important issue, but it is not a compelling paradigm. And the issues that are involved, it is very hard to reduce to present value. We have Paul Bonn here in the audience, who put up the money for this, who has invented a new currency with some other people, and I just happen to have somebody here. It's called a B, for blend of methodologies of measuring both social and economic and security aspects of what we have to do to come up with a whole new different way so that we will be able in the present to take the decisions that are going to affect the future, where almost none of us do it so far. It's going to be hard to get that vision, but what's going to be required, as the general already said, is two things: political will and leadership. These five gentlemen have committed one of the cardinal sins. I call it the sin of leadership. They didn't wait for somebody else. They went out and they got in front, and they have done it at an important moment to come here to speak to the future of power here in the United States as we go through one of the most profound rethinking processes of our role in the outside world that we have ever done. And one of the most important insights they have, and from my perspective, maybe the most important insight beyond the vision, is the need to integrate instruments of power and influence. Lessons that have been learned by what these people and others did on the ground in Bosnia, in Kosovo, that we, the United States, are learning in Iraq, and is being done today in Afghanistan, which is the test. If any of this is going to work, we collectively have to get Afghanistan right, not just this year, but over the many years we're going to have to be involved. And that is about hearts and minds to a great extent, not as an ancillary matter as it was in the Cold War, but as many parts as a central proposition. The integration of instruments of power and influence. And I'm going to lay down a marker now why, in some ways, for us, it's even more difficult than these people with their vision are saying. If you take the two broad accounts that we spend money on the outside world, the 050 account, Office of Management Budget, which is military matters, and the 15 account, which is the State Department, USAID, foreign aid, international institutions, military aid, the ratio of spending in this country is 17 to 1. That's ludicrous if we're going to get it right. Ludicrous. We're going to have to shift that, and we're going to have to shift it within the alliance, and that's what these gentlemen are leading on. Now, what do we need to do as a practical way in the first place? Number one is to get NATO right. I perhaps would like to see NATO do less of the non-military and to get the lessons learned out of Afghanistan and otherwise right, and to get the leadership returned to NATO, and yes, for the United States to return to NATO as the place of first recourse when we talk about anything in the outside world. Recognizing that a lot of the things we do in the outside world, as our attention shifts not just to the Middle East but to the Far East, a lot of those things don't fit naturally within the purview of NATO, but that's the place where we need to start building these relations. Number two, to recognize, as these gentlemen do, that when you get to the real problems of the future, the repository of what is possible is in the North Atlantic community plus a few friends elsewhere. Stable governments, democracies, populations that are well-educated and well-trained, a capacity to project not just power elsewhere, but values, capacities, and things in the civilian field. The United States, if the medical profession in the United States, what we spend on health, were a country, it would be the seventh largest economy in the world. You combine that with the allies, this is the great repository of capacity, public and private, what we call non-governmental organizations. That's what is being mobilized by this report. And that means, among other things, the United States has to develop not just renewed leadership with these people of NATO, but also to forge a strategic partnership with the European Union, and I don't mean in the military, I mean in health, in education, in job creation, in all the things not only will take away from the terrorists their recruiting capacities, but it's going to give us a chance actually to shape the world and get onto these things where there is not much a return to present value. The NATO-EU relationship, which to a great extent now is paralyzed and is poisonous, it's ludicrous. 15 years ago, when I got in this business, I commented that NATO and the European Union lived in the same town in Brussels on separate planets. There was zero interconnection. Today, there's much more in it, but there's more to come. And somebody yesterday, Jim Townsend, let's give him credit from the Atlantic Council, said at this Bucharest summit, NATO should appoint a committee of people, of top people, to say, we're going to get that relationship with the European Union right, finally. And to get to challenge the European Union to do likewise. Because if we can't get those two institutions working together, we're not going to get anywhere. And they've said that in this report. It's remarkable that we have the countries represented here who, if their leadership would do it, the five countries here, we can get that done. But that's got to happen. That's the agenda, I think, for Bucharest. And we have an opportunity now with the new French government in perspective of the new American government. Now, let's be clear. This is going to take political cooperation across the Atlantic of unprecedented quality in the post-Cold War era. Now, whether that should be done with a group that is the United States, NATO, and the European Union getting together, I don't know. But it's clear it's going to have to be at the top level transatlantically. And to recognize that this is not just a bunch of people sitting around saying nice things to one another, they're going to be real problems. There are real differences of interest, despite those things that bind us together. And the most difficult, in some ways, covered by this report, is defining what the military challenges are and the military responses. We are not always going to agree on that. We don't agree on it now. We don't necessarily agree on the parts of the world. But we're going to have to find a way to have the agreements to overwhelm the disagreements. Now, we're going to have a new president next year. A trend that's already begun under this administration, which is going to be a recognition that we cannot do things alone. We may be able to make war alone. We can't make peace for alone. This we now understand in both political parties. Whoever's going to be president understands that. And the next president is going to reach out to allies in a major way. But let us be clear. There are going to be demands of allies as well. The world isn't going to change. We are going to demand of allies. First and foremost, that they do more in Afghanistan, on which the alliance has bet its future. That does involve caveats. It does involve more forces. It does involve doing an awful lot more on the non-military side. Appointing a supremo, Lord Ashdown or somebody else, is going to be a major step in the right direction. We're going to have to cut the Europeans some slack, not just seeing what do you do militarily? That's the only thing that counts. We have to have a new accounting system that if they do things non-militarily, they can get credit for that as well, because we're all in it together. All the resources have to be blended together. Iraq, we are going to expect, whatever happens in Iraq, a lot more European engagement on the non-military side, and we're going to expect that to happen. And what's the word that was used by the last Secretary General? Capabilities, capabilities, capabilities. We will take the Europeans seriously only if they will respond in terms of the action to match the rhetoric of these people. Then they can come here and demand that we pay more attention to them on times when we're not, and we can demand of them, because it is this joint set of understandings and capabilities that's going to add up to the new vision that they're going to lead on. All right, finally, let me just say what I said a bit earlier. These gentlemen have committed the sin of political leadership. That's what's going to be involved. It's taking their ideas in this time of fertility and transition as we prepare a new team, I trust a bipartisan team, in the next administration. Whoever's president, I hope they reach out in one of the top three or four jobs and find a senior person, a real person of the opposite party, the way Roosevelt did in 1940 with Stimson and Knox. To understand that we can do nothing in this country unless we do it together, bipartisan. We can do nothing together with the alliance unless we recognize that we're going to have the tools and the ambition and the qualities and the discussion that we haven't had for the last 15 years or so. So I salute these gentlemen, and I hope I haven't made their job even more difficult. They are the future. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ambassador, for those remarks. I couldn't agree with you more. I think it will be challenging to implement many of the ideas that have been outlined in this terrific report. But I do think, like you, that the time is ripe. We have a number of opportunities before us. We've got upcoming NATO summits. We've got significant changes in political leadership, either that have recently occurred on the other side of the Atlantic or soon to happen on this side of the Atlantic. And, of course, we have major changes inside the European Union with progress being made on the reform treaty. We are crawling out from under the shadows of Iraq. So I think there are plenty of open windows, and I hope we take advantage of those opportunities in the months and years ahead. We have the good fortune of having the entire Gang of Five here up on the panel with us. They're all prepared to answer questions. I'm going to open up the floor immediately. I just ask that you identify yourself and you wait for the microphone. This is being filmed by C-SPAN, so we want to make sure that everyone can be heard and that their questions will come through loud and clear. So who would like to start with the first question? Esther, I'll turn the floor over to you. Just wait for the microphone, please.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the panel and to the distinguished authors of this group. We are all very much in your debt for sharing your wisdom with all of us, so thank you, and I know we all look forward to reading this in a great depth. I'm Esther Brimmer from the Center for Transatlantic Relations. I wanted to explore a little bit more the thinking behind the role of the strategic director, in a sense, which is an exciting idea to bring together at critical moments of crisis both the European Union and NATO. And I was also interested to see in the report the role of conflict prevention and seeing the need to engage early in crises. But often, one of the challenges for political and military leaders is having the political will to engage early at the early stage before a crisis deteriorates. That would suggest that the steering mechanism could play an important role in generating that political will. Yet, just at my initial hearing, it sounded as if the steering mechanism would only become engaged once a crisis was absolutely critical and perhaps that past that point of engagement. Could we explore a little bit further the role of that steering mechanism in generating political will for conflict prevention? Thank you.
There you go.
Let me first react on your last, on your last remark on the preventive phase of the proposed strategy we proposed. It's a very good question, because indeed you have to link it to the political will to make it work. And if if you see what we wrote down, then we quite broadly defined what under such a phase should be done. And that's a real wide range of issues, going from avoiding poverty to resolving local conflicts to get access to certain resources. And the thing is that this phase in this concept is now a real integrated phase of the total strategy. That means it's not just a part strategy for a part of the game. No, it belongs to one strategy, and it's an extreme important part of it. And the thing there is that linking this to political will, if you don't have a concept like this, you have more difficulties in having a real good concept to decide on. And if you have this strategy, then it forces you more or less in a kind of mechanism to have all the items on a row. And it also provides a common vision, a common ground for a political solution and decision. And as you know, nothing is worse than that if there's no common vision for a political decision. The second point on the directorate, I would like to give the floor to Klaus, General Naumann. I'm sure he's an expert on that.
Not a real surprise, Hank, but thank you anyway. Our basic approach is that we use existing organizations. And the second assumption, which was one of our, one of our points of departure, is that we live in such an uncertain world that we cannot wait for the new vision to develop something which might be better than the existing organizations. So we said, let's try to find the best possible way how to make work better, how to strengthen organizations. Then we thought about the conflicts, and we came to the conclusion that presumably only a few of conflicts can be solved by what I would call monodimensional organizations, such as NATO, which disposes of military means only. But particularly in the early phases of a conflict, you may need other than military means to diffuse the conflict. Having only the organizations which we have, we said it's not bad if we bring them together and establish a directorate which will be given the task to look in all crises, conflicts, difficult situations, to identify who can act best, who is best capable to take action, to take the lead, and the others support them. It's following the old military principle, which we all are familiar with, of supporting and being supported. And that is the idea behind this. And we thought, if we had something like this, if it begins to work, then the vision, the long-term vision, which is in our paper, that we may one day arrive at an alliance of all the free nations between Finland and Alaska, which encompasses more than the military field, may take, shape. It may form over time, since this directorate could perhaps be successful. That, I think, is the idea behind the directorate and how we could make it work.
I understand that also Lord Inch, Field Marshal Inch, would like to comment on this.
I mean, I would endorse both what has been said by Hank and by Cloud. But the trouble within my nation, if I look at it, often these things become crises which are actually humanitarian rather than just military. You may need some military force to help that humanitarian crisis. What is sad at times is some of the humanitarian agencies do not like working with the military. And I think that if we're going to make it work, we've got to learn to work together in a much better way than we do at the moment.
Great. All right. Reggie, you had a question. I think I'm going to collect two questions. Reggie, you'll be the first one. Go ahead. Wait for the microphone. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Reginald Dale of the CSIS here. Following on what Ambassador Hunter said, I'm certainly all in favor of leadership in this field. I want to ask a question, though, about how propitious the general broader political environment is at the moment, given that in Washington, you can't help running into people who keep saying that Europe does not play such a major role in U.S. global strategy as it used to. You have the State Department moving diplomats out of Europe, the Pentagon moving troops out of Europe, and the U.S. media hardly cover Europe at all. On the European side, you have countless opinion polls showing opposition to U.S. leadership and also mounting opposition to the European troop deployment in Afghanistan. So I'm wondering how all these trends, this background affects the hope for your proposals.
All right, that's question number one. I'm going to take one more. Harlan, all the way in the back, if you could also wait for the microphone. There's one right next to you. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Harlan Ullman, also here at CSIS. I'd like to use Bob Hunter's commentary to put it in a question, who shall lead? Who shall lead, with reference to NATO. We are not winning in Afghanistan. We're not winning on the civil side. When you take a look at the alliance, there's an absence of urgency to consider anything of importance, whether it's Afghanistan or the strategic concept. The Secretary General and the Chairman of the Military Committee both will say we need this, but nothing is going to happen until a new president is elected. And given the time it takes to fill an administration, we're talking about midway at least through 2009. It seems to me that the profound question that NATO has to wrestle with is how do you maintain a military alliance in the absence of a military threat? Now, everybody from SACEUR on down appreciates the need for protection of the homeland and security, change in the alliance from a military alliance to one that deals with security. But how do we do that? It seems to me that is the nut of the problem. How do we implement your excellent recommendations? I would appreciate some guidance about who shall lead.
Thank you very much for both those questions, which are really touching on the very heart of, very core of our paper. And they have to do, they are interlinked with each other. Let me first give a few comments, and then I would like to hand the floor to my French opponent.
And me too.
And after that, we go back to the French-German axe. So we go to, and maybe then the only active serving member of our panel, Lord Inch, will comment a little bit. No, I think my remark would be that on the last question, how do we make this work, is first of all, it's our opinion that, and that you smell it, you see it. When you are in NATO and when you work with NATO, and when you talk about the EU-NATO relationship, and we know it all from our practical life, as we all have our things, is that sometimes you have phases where you get stuck. In the kind of mechanism that you ask for changes all the time for the same, or you ask for changes all the time for more in the same, and instead of then being a serious issues, it ends up in a kind of mechanism. And one of the needs to go beyond that mechanism, very often, and we believe that's the case in this, is to create a common vision, to create chemistry. And there, the first remark of John Hambry, which looked so innocent, but is very, very valuable, because the first thing is start to talk to each other again. I mean, this sounds ridiculous, it sounds very simple, but it's a basic issue. And the second thing is that we should involve all the politicians, but especially also the societies, because the public awareness has everything to do how do we communicate what's going on. So having said that, I think one of the answers to your very rightly and difficult question is to start with a new impetus, to start with a new catalyzing, a common vision, which can then lead to a new momentum. But I have said now already enough, so I turn over to Admiral Langsaat.
Thank you. It's true that the image of the relationship between the US and France is not as good as it needed to be. I think the relationship between our two countries is very, very important, and there is no aggressive position of France vis-à-vis the U.S. People. That is exactly the contrary. What is at stake is the decision-making process between the two sides of the Atlantic. And I think we have to progress toward a common view of the common assessment of the situation, and after that to try to find, to agree on a strategy to solve the crisis. I think it's mainly the decision-making process between the two sides of the Atlantic which is really at stake.
Well, turning to the first question first, I think you're really wrong if you believe that the Europeans are opposed to the Americans in principle. The majority of Europeans believes firmly that there is no security for Europe without the United States of America. That is a common ground in Europe. There may be poise, but what are poise? You saw it just in New Hampshire. The basic conviction is still there. Of course, we have had some problems with the present administration, but administrations come and go. And so we have to look into the longer-lasting convictions, and we still have common values, common convictions, and we still see that we cannot survive. I'm using this dramatic word. We cannot survive in a world in which we are confronted with people who do not share our values, who unfortunately are in the majority in terms of numbers, and who are extremely hungry to see success. So if we want to survive, we have to stand together. And I think that is a view which the majority in Europe shares, and I think also the majority in the United States understands. You are the most powerful nation in the world, no doubt about this. And you can defeat militarily every country in the world, but you cannot win on your own. And for that reason, you need us. And we are the only bunch of people in the world who share with you the same convictions, the same values. So I think the answer is easy. We have to arrive at a common conclusion, and we have to work together, again, making existing organizations working better. That's the name of the game. And Harlan, to your question, who shall lead? No doubt, the principle is still that leadership has to be commensurate to contributions. Who is making the biggest contributions has to have the first say. But to pick up one principle which was so prominent here in town a couple of months or years ago, the mission defines the coalition is a fundamentally flawed perception. That's deadly wrong. What has to be valid is the coalition decides whether there is a common mission. And as soon as the decision is taken, then all who participated in this decision have to share risks, burdens collectively. And if you follow that line, no problem to arrive at a new conclusion, at a new common ground. And then, since you mentioned the military committee, Harlan, then the military committee might perhaps one day again be able to discuss military issues and not be a mini council which discusses political issues, which should be the domain of the ambassadors. And the council could perhaps then refrain from being a platoon leader seminar without being trained as a platoon leader.
Just very quickly add to that. First of all, I think making the strength of NATO, which inevitably I passionately believe in, I think it goes two ways. It has to be us showing our commitment to NATO, but equally coming across the Atlantic must be the American commitment to NATO. And that is fundamentally important. I would agree with all what Klaus has said about the importance of NATO, and if you talk to most Europeans who are thinking about this, perhaps we don't make it as obvious as we should do, but there is no doubt about, in all the people I talk in the British government, whatever the party, believes very strongly in that link. Turning now to Afghanistan, I don't think you can look at Afghanistan, frankly, in isolation. As you know, not as large as the American commitment, but we have a significant commitment in Afghanistan. Part of the problem with Afghanistan was that actually I don't think we looked through properly what was involved in going into that very difficult country. We didn't look at its history. We didn't make a proper military appreciation. And on top of that, Iraq was an unpopular war, where actually it was much easier to justify the reasons we were going to in Afghanistan than it was actually to going into Iraq. And so that is part of the problem. But I don't think you should read the wrong lessons about what is happening in either of those countries.
May I just follow up one remark on Europe again? I think it's fair to say that you see a change in attitude. For example, if you take our critical country and you look at the contribution, the discussion on extending the mission in Afghanistan, you really see a change in attitude of people. Thank you.
Great. All right. I'm going to take three questions this time. Rem, we're going to start with you. If you'd wait for the microphone, do we have one coming up to the front of the room? Bring that up. And then we're pleased to have the ambassador to Belgium. You wanted to make a remark, sir. I believe we'll turn to you second. Belgium. Yes, I'm sorry. Forgive me. Yes. Rem, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Rem Korteweg at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies in the Netherlands. I have two short questions for the panel. Could you possibly share your thoughts on the relevance still of Article 5, the core component that keeps NATO together? Is the wording still relevant for this new security environment that you talk about in your article? An armed attack against one or other members. What is an armed attack? In this new grand strategy, should we redefine Article 5, rewrite it, add an addendum? Is it still sufficient? Second question, if I may be slightly pessimistic, I'm afraid that for all the value that you are writing in this paper, it might be viewed by critics as, here are five generals telling the world how it should integrate its non-military activities. How are we going to engage the non-military communities without risking the very nature of what you're writing in this report? In other words, will it take also a group of five development aid heads or a group of five ambassadors who also come forth and say this is a very good step forward and this is what it takes to integrate the non-military agencies with the military component? Thank you.
Great, thanks. Mr. Ambassador, let's wait for the microphone. If you can.
So thank you very much for these very stimulating proposals. You know, I think I can agree with most of the points, you know, which were mentioned in this issue, but I think you're touching one of the most fundamental issues, you know, is this cooperation between the three big international institutions which we are part of, United Nations, NATO, and the European Union. I think this is one really of the key issues. And, you know, as some were saying, you know, in Brussels, they are living on a different planet, and it's absolutely right. It's enough already to listen in NATO when they speak about European Union. It's downtown, which is already very pessimistic, you know, and neglecting another thing. But I think we should also remember that everything we are doing at the moment is also taking part within the United Nations. I haven't found that much about the United Nations, you know, which is nevertheless, for all NATO operations at the moment, the guiding framework of our operations. And I think, you know, going deeper into all these things, I would like to ask you to write an addendum to your paper, because, you know, I think if there is no unifying vision at the moment of compelling paradigm, as Ambassador Hunter said, you know, we have that compelling test of Afghanistan, you know, which is maybe far more important, you know, than a very long-term vision. But could you apply the rules you're proposing in your paper to Afghanistan, I think is the most urgent thing. And I was listening with great interest to Field Marshal Inge also saying, you know, Afghanistan, maybe we had a wrong historical approach at a certain stage, and try to find out, because this is the real test at the moment, you know, we are facing immediately. And I would like to see these three organizations, you know, working much better together. And, you know, in the introduction, it was also said that there is a lot of stovepiping within our national institution, which is absolutely right. You quite often have the impression that, you know, within different capitals, and mine definitely, you know, there are three planets in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or within the same government, and trying to bring them together, you know, realigning, you know, the amount of money we spend on the military side, on the development side, and on the political side, you know. And there I was very amused and very pleased to hear Gates proposing more means, you know, for the political side and for the development side, seems to be all issues, you know. And I would propose, you know, an addendum to your paper, you know, how can we draw the lessons of your paper and apply it immediately in Afghanistan? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. If you could just hand it to Jerry Livingston for the last question of this round. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Jerry Livingston from the German Historical Institute. I've got two quick questions, if I may. Picking up from what Bob Sunder said, NATO has changed. So my first question is, well, I'll ask it to Klaus Naumann, since his country is closest to the Eastern Europe. Why, as a member of this panel, were there no representatives from the new any of the new NATO countries? I know it's hard to get a Hungarian admiral or a Czech admiral, but why not get one of these smart Czech generals, or smart Hungarian generals? So my question, perhaps to Mr. Rehm, is why is there no representation from the new NATO states, which have been in NATO for a good long time? The second question I'll ask to whatever the expert on the panel is for intelligence relates to intelligence sharing. On page 83 of the report, you say it needs improvement in intelligence sharing. Seems to me it's one of the most difficult problems. If there's ever an institution that's national to its core, it's intelligence services. And then you call for something on page 142, has a kind of a nuclear ring, an intelligence fusion center. And you say that there, in this fusion center, intelligence that is corroborated intelligence would be exchanged. What in heaven's name do you mean by corroborated? If you wait for corroboration, you have to wait sometimes for a very long time.
Thank you. I'm very glad that you mentioned this last word, because I didn't know it before I wrote this book, corroborated. I think the issue on the intelligence, to start with there, is a major issue, because if you speak to the people who are involved, then you must conclude what is written in our paper, that it's still very much focused on the Cold War structure, and it's very fragmented. And of course, there you have a national interest. But there again, I think especially there again, a common vision on such a preventive phase of a certain strategy will help to focus capabilities, directions, and visions. And so our proposal comes from there, and we think it's very urgently. Now, on your question, why not somebody from the new members in our group? That's a very good question. Some of us have also the same kind of group with, for example, countries like Austria, Switzerland. And the fact that we have a Shalikashvili in our midst, a Shalikashvili who comes from that part, nearly that part, made up everything in that sense. So thank you, John, that you are here. Going back to the first question coming from The Hague, very good questions. I think, Klaus, those are very good questions for you.
Okay, I'll take up the gauntlet, no problem. Let me first come back to your issue, yeah. Jerry, on the corroborated, this wonderful word which is so often used by American intelligence officers. I can give you an example what I saw when I was chairman of the military committee. There was a defense minister of an old NATO country who approached NATO and said, we have a wonderful piece of intelligence. The Serbs, it was in the Kosovo air campaign, the Serbs developed a horseshoe plan, which indicates that they have premeditated how to expel all the Kosovars out of Kosovo, and they have launched a military operation, and step by step, and this was following a principle of a horseshoe around Kosovo. This defense minister urged me, as chairman of the military committee, to accept this as NATO intelligence, NATO agreed intelligence, one nation. And I said, no, minister, no way. We need corroboration by other NATO countries. So we ask around who has similar intelligence. We did not find a single NATO country who had a similar piece of information. We had one neutral country, which was prepared to indicate that there was something which pointed in this direction. And we had one country which is now a member of the alliance but was not back in 1999. And they said, yes, very true. So when I got this result, I phoned this minister back and said, sir, awfully sorry. This will not be corroborated NATO intelligence, since we did not get proper confirmation. And that's what we mean. And you all are familiar with the, I should say, the experiences we all gained with intelligence in the last 7 years or so, not to speak of last November's publications. So we are, I think we simply wanted to indicate, be cautious and don't allow intelligence, which is still to a large degree driven by the attitudes of the Bazaar of Istanbul, which is part of the NATO territory, but which should not govern the exchange of information. But this is still the reality. We have this Cold War syndrome with us. If I have a little piece of information, I give it to you. If you give me in exchange something. That's an attitude, ladies and gentlemen, which we have to abandon pretty urgently, since otherwise we'll fall again and again into the traps of prefabricated, manipulated pieces of information. And perhaps history will one day tell us who was behind all this thing. I'm following the reader of, let's say, novels to always try to identify who had a motive in producing the intelligence. And we have seen a marvelous result if the producers were those who I have in, I suspect to be the producers. Coming back to your question, Article 5. Ladies and gentlemen, I would, despite all vagueness of Article 5, I would very much advise against rewriting Article 5. It has served us in all its vagueness pretty well. And you will never get nations to sign up to something which is more precise. What we should do, however, is, and we have seen the example last year, we need to think through what means in international legal terms an attack. If a country is suddenly subject to an electronic attack which neutralizes the entire economic system, and if we see that there are 1.2 million computers working together in an organized, well-synchronized way without knowing who was behind this entire thing, we need to think through whether this constitutes an attack or not and whether this would constitute an Article 5 case or not. In my view, in this case last year, NATO and the EU miserably failed in coming to the assistance of a small country which was subject to, I should say, a hostile activity. That we need to sort out. But that's, I think, is all weird. But there's nothing new. We have always had to think through what means an attack under international law in the development of our modern day, since the time is changing from time to time. And coming to your last point, they will say this are four or five military dinosaurs. Well, fine. We have no problem with that. First of all, we said among ourselves, we see that the young generation loves dinosaurs. So why shouldn't we offer for the young generation something which will determine their future? And if you read the paper, you will see we are not focusing on military steps. Very much to the contrary. And should the group of five non-governmental organizations or the group of five humanitarian aid organizations develop a similar strategy, fine. Then we put it together. We do not claim that this is the silver bullet. We simply want to throw a stone into the silent and rather muddy pot, a pond of international organizations, to encourage them to start to think about something, since without a strategy, at least that is, I think, a German and a French common view, without a strategy, you will never find the proper means how to act.
If I, very quickly, because a lot of what I want to say has already been said, but I will tell my grandchildren that they must love a dinosaur. But first of all, on the intelligence side, I mean, I recognize the enormous importance of, before undertaking any military operation, the importance that intelligence plays in that operation. But often, if I think back to my experience, we loved reading highly sensitive information. But a lot of the decisions we were made were not made on very sensitive information. They were made on actually careful analysis of the sort of threats that we might face. So I think we shouldn't over-exaggerate the important. Intelligence is vital, but I don't think we should over-exaggerate the problems within NATO as far as intelligence is concerned. It could be much better done, and the way it's presented could be better done. But I don't actually need to exaggerate it. Article 5, I would totally endorse what Klaus Naumann has said. On the hearts and minds side, or whatever you want to call it, I absolutely agree that any of the military campaigns we're engaged in at the moment have a huge and often bigger hearts and minds dimension than they do, in fact, on a military dimension. And one of our problems in Afghanistan is that we haven't got that side of the equation right, partly because there aren't enough forces on the ground to provide the protection for the hearts and minds or the NGOs or whatever they are, aid to go in. I think we need to look more what I would call muscular aid. I don't mean, but you need support, not necessarily military support, but they've got to be there with some form of protection to help them deliver that aid. Because if you, again, look at Afghanistan, some of the very simple things like clean water, low medical support, it is not getting through to people. And we're losing that campaign, even though we may be having tactical, and I suggest tactical success, not strategic, tactical sense against the Taliban. So unless we get that right in Afghanistan, we risk failure, is what I believe.
Yes, I just would like to give a small comment on what the ambassador said on the addendum. I think to translate this idea to the process what's now going on and which has been started in Edinburgh would be a very good idea, because it forces, as we have said in the beginning, also to come up with a very clear, defined political aim and objective. And as long as you don't have that, it's very difficult to work out in a convincing way what then you need and make things to work together. So if it's going to be an addendum, but I liked your idea. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to gather three more questions. I'm going to start with John, if you'll wait for the microphone. And then, yes, we'll get to you and your neighbor, Chris. Yeah, and then I've got one final round after that, and then we're going to have to wrap things up. Go ahead, John.
Thank you very much. My name is John Sandrock. I'm with Analytic Services Incorporated. I'd like to go back to what the Belgian ambassador asked. And basically emphasize, and this, he actually anticipated my question, but I don't think you've answered it, if I may be so bold as to suggest that. I think Afghanistan, as Ambassador Hunter also mentioned, is a critical case, and I would like to see an application of your program and your suggestions in a kind of a case study scenario applied to Afghanistan. What would you do? Beyond that, I would also suggest that there are other potential crisis areas that we need to look at. Kosovo comes to mind immediately, where NATO is also heavily involved. But I also would mention Georgia with Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where certainly Western Europe and the United States must play some kind of a role in support of the current government there and in the objectives and in the sense of democracy and development. Nagorno-Karabakh, the crisis between Armenia and Azerbaijan, continues for 15 years. And if you are going to apply the phases of strategic application implementation, which are to reduce the causes of conflict, proactive crisis management, enforcement with or without military, and finally post-intervention stabilization, I think those are the four phases that need to be applied to these potentially very serious issues. And if we take a look at this from an implementation perspective, I would challenge you, perhaps, if I may do that, to look at these and say, okay, how do we practically implement these with real case involvement, with real looking at real cases? Thank you.
Great, thanks. We'll have two neighbors. Yes, go ahead, we'll start with you. It should be on.
I'm Glenda Rosenthal from Columbia University Institute for the Study of Europe, and
it's wonderful to come here from New York and get rid of the idea that New York is the center of the world. It's a real pleasure. I have one very sort of global question. It seems to me you're proposing a very grand strategy extending from, to quote your proposal, from Alaska to Finland, which clearly leaves out, at least I believe it leaves out, Russia and Central Asia and going further east, China and India, not to mention Pakistan. Obviously, I'm not asking you if we want to establish an alliance that is really almost global, but does this not, your proposal, doesn't it carry within it implicitly and even explicitly the establishment of a kind of neo-bipolar world, a sort of us versus them international arena? And I think this is very dangerous and could lead to the intensification rather than the reduction of conflict.
Okay, could you just hand that to your neighbor, Chris?
Yeah, Christian Wernicke, working for the German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung. I'd like to, and I had worked for 7 years in Brussels. I can assure you that I totally share the assessment of the dinosaurs that NATO is a very boring organization, at least media-wise at the moment. I mean, there was no more boring thing than covering NATO councils meetings because they didn't talk to each other in the time when I was there, but that was especially during the Iraq War. I'd like to get a little bit more clearer idea about this central idea of your concept about this directorate. I understand that since a lot of practical problems, military problems, challenges are unmet because of the political cork that's kind of sitting on the top of the bottle, this lack of common vision, this lack of common will, you want to use this directorate as an opener. So could you describe a little bit who will be part of the directorate? Is it president level? Is it Minister of Defense? I mean, part of this directorate's job will not be only to open the organizational difficulty and the bottlenecks there, but part of this job, I understand, would also be to show to the public, to do some sort of job as public diplomacy, that the Atlantic Alliance is there, has a new basis of values and objectives. And how do you make sure that it's not one of these other ministerial meetings like we have at NATO or even in the EU 10 kilometers away, which all the people like me, journalists, go there and we're bored again? Thanks.
Thank you for all the three very, very good questions. Let me react on the first question, Clausen. Yes, your idea following up the ambassador, it sounds and it is very logic, and we as persons are very positive on such a suggestion, because as you have heard, we also see the critical thing of Afghanistan, if it's going to work or not, but also the other issues and tasks you have mentioned, and it would be logic and consequent to translate this strategy into the phases where the management of those conflicts are, and also to use then to work as a catalyzer to get the vision right to end or to bring these missions to them. So your idea is very, very sympathetic to us, and we will bring it in the group if we will find the time, because as you know, we all volunteers to do this. So if you make governments asking this or NATO asking this, we certainly will not say no. So thank you very much for your remark. On the strategic concept, that was a very good question. Thank you. And because you mentioned the word the word dangerous, I immediately give it to Klaus.
But if you allow me, I would also like to briefly comment on your question, which was a very pertinent question. And I should say we played for quite some time during the process of working on this paper with the idea whether we should not add an annex on Afghanistan. But then we very practically said it's virtually impossible to do this, since we are confronted with a moving target. You cannot work on a paper and get it printed, which requires some time, in a situation which is pretty fluid. But in Afghanistan, we are, in without any doubt, in most cases, in the post-conflict stabilization operation. There are still some, I should say, some inlets of enforcement in it, which will always be the case, since these phases go hand in glove. And what we suggested in our paper would be applicable to Afghanistan as well. Afghanistan is not primarily a military problem. If we had some of the steps we propose implemented in Afghanistan right now, the NATO commander would be in a much better shape.
Absolutely.
Think of the caveats, think of the operational command versus operational control issue. Think of the option that the NATO Council should not for 5 months discuss whether out of an inventory of 800 helicopters, 5 could be deployed to Afghanistan, which is a platoon leader's task, I should say, and Field Marshal Inge, Admiral Lassin, General van der Bremen, and I would have been very angry, I should say, with our military subordinates if they had brought to our attention the question of 5 helicopters in a real operation during the Cold War days. We would never have accepted this as a level of general staff decision. It's somewhat down the road. In Afghanistan, we need to find a better way how to implement, I should say, stabilization efforts so that the people in this country understand it at all levels, in all parts of the country, that NATO is there to change things for the better. And they don't feel it right now in many places. So we have to reinforce our efforts, which also means to spend more money. Otherwise, we can't do it. And to mention 3 examples where we miserably failed. Police, total failure. Unfortunately, my own country was responsible for that. But it's a failure. Well, we cannot change it. Judiciary system, Italy was responsible for that. Failure. The truck issue. Initially, the United Kingdom was responsible for that. Not one of the masterpieces in performance. So there we are. And if we don't, let's say, break this vicious cycle between the drug lords, the armaments procurement, and the rearmament of local militia, we will not be able to stabilize Afghanistan. So I think if we applied our strategy, it could well produce an improvement in the situation. But again, we come back to an issue which General van den Bremen has mentioned again and again. This is a question of political will. And at the moment, allow me to say this so bluntly, our publics in all our 26 NATO countries regard Afghanistan as a war which they outsourced. A couple of stupid military have to make sure that this will be resolved. But otherwise, we don't care. That is a situation we need to change. Otherwise, we risk the failure of this alliance. And I hope the people will understand this. And if I go to the other issues, if one thought about our strategy and its application in Kosovo, perhaps one would not be as generous in pushing for unilateral recognition as
the international community is at this point in time. Perhaps one will think twice, I don't know. Perhaps one will start to think at all. Might also be a good option. And one could perhaps think about the repercussion this may have on problems which you mentioned, Abkhazia and Ossetia. What will we do should Russia declare its willingness to acknowledge Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent countries tomorrow? What will be our reaction? Do we have a blueprint for that? I'm not aware, but I'm no longer in government, fortunately. So our strategy is applicable on this issue. So now coming back to the us versus them. No, our paper doesn't suggest that. Our paper advocates dialogue, cooperation with all who are willing to work together with us. We're not producing a bipolar world. We want to be in a dialogue with them, and we do not want to push them into one corner. But on the other hand, I think we have, the five of us have no illusions that you cannot solve all problems through dialogue. There will remain problems which will require to go down the hard road, since it's one of the things in the human nature which we cannot change. Human beings are qualified to do good things, but they are also qualified to do terrible things, and that we will never eradicate. And for that reason, dialogue alone is not the answer. And now to the directorate, the last point, who shall be represented there? I think when we discussed this idea, we said the representatives in this directorate should be at the top, the President of the United States, the Secretary General of NATO, and in the European Union, this new gentleman will emerge after the Lisbon Treaty has been eliminated. Is that that was a wonderful Freudian slip. Now, as soon as the Lisbon Treaty is implemented, we will have someone who will represent Europe. And this gentleman has then to be the representative. Of course, such high-level people have to have their, let's say, ambassadors who do the daily work. That needs to be appointed. But I think this gives you an indication who should be in this directorate. And I think this could be a formula which could work if there is, again, the political will to make it happen.
Chuck.
Yes, I would add some comments on this directorate. First, I fully agree with what Klaus said, and especially the fact that the representatives, the participants, have to be at the highest level. But I think it's too early to enter more precisely in the way this directorate has to act, to function. I think we put the idea on the table, and now, if this idea could be agreed, after that it will be time to look at exactly how this directorate has to be organized. Second point: I remember what is the role of this directorate is to try to obtain a common assessment of the situation, to decide which organization has to take the lead, and third, to organize the support of the others organization. But what is very new in our proposal is the fact that we have to avoid confrontation between EU and NATO. And what we suggest is, under the umbrella of NATO, within the alliance, to have EU and US looking at the situation and taking the decision together, or trying to take the decision together. I think that is where this point is very new from my point of view. And if such a directorate exists and obtain some results, to approach a broader consensus within the West. I think after that, the Western countries should be in a better position to influence the United Nations. And I think it's very important that in this situation we have in this world, we are able to show that the Western countries are on the same way, have the same approach of the question. And my final point is you put on the table the program of the first meeting of the directorate.
Lord Inch.
If I could just return to Afghanistan. I think the problem of Afghanistan has perhaps in some ways been underplayed, and I don't think we are in parts of Afghanistan in the post-stabilization phase. I think particularly in the south and the east, in Helmand, we are actually still very much engaged, and we are having, I would argue, tactical-level success against the Taliban, but we're by no means achieving operational or strategic success against the Taliban. And what is happening in Pakistan raises a very big question mark and makes me personally much more concerned. But if we don't actually win there, the damage it will do to NATO, I hardly need stress to you. As I say, we are having tactical success, but we are doing the problem you very much highlighted about producing the hearts and minds, the aid that we need to have on ground. So we've got some way to go, in the south. And I'm worried not only about Pakistan, but I'm also worried about the number of now foreign fighters that are beginning to appear in Pakistan. And quite rightly, people have talked about the poppy crop. We still have no proper strategic plan for replacing the poppy crop, and it's no good just destroying it because we'll lose their hearts and minds very quickly. We have to somehow put some form of aid in to replace that poppy crop or we'll get in a muddle. So in my view, Afghanistan remains a huge challenge still to be resolved.
That's by the way, nice to mention, and that is that on this last issue, replace the poppy crop, the Nova Foundation plays a role as well, from experience from the Gaza.
Well, the Gang of Five, they have an engagement in the not-too-distant future, but I am going to do one final speed round here because I do have four people who have been waiting very patiently. I ask that you each just take 30 seconds, if you could, to send a question to the panel, and then we're going to give both Ambassador Hunter and General Shali Kashvili the chance to close out with some concluding remarks. So first on my list for the final round of questions, again, please be brief, is Stanley. If you could wait for the mic. We'll get one right there, and then I'll turn to Andrew. Go ahead, please.
Institute, I'd like to follow up the bipolar question. In 1995, I was in Moscow at a conference. First question, how do you explain the rise of anti-Americanism in Russia, 1995? Answer from a Russian, we have not been accepted by the West as a member of any of its institutions. And just the language in the report divides Russia from the West. Take a look at Putin's press conference with the Indian Prime Minister a couple of months ago. He is pushing a Russia-China-India arrangement very strongly. The Indian Prime Minister will be in China next week. The Chinese are cultivating India. I'm really concerned that this question of the vision of the world may be underestimated.
And if you could just hand it to Andrew.
Andrew Pierre, Georgetown University. We focused on Afghanistan, but I was delighted to see Lord Inge talk about Pakistan. I think that as I look out in the future, it seems to me the two principal questions are Iraq. Bob Hunter, Ambassador Hunter, excuse me, talked about the need for European involvement in the what I would call the reconstruction of Iraq. But if we look around today, there's very little European consciousness or willingness or political will to get involved in that. The United States, as the ambassador said, may demand European involvement, but you know, American demands don't always work so well with our European friends these days. And I'm struck by the absence of discussion in the transatlantic dialogue about the need for getting Iraq right, not militarily, where the Europeans are not going to be involved, but politically, economically, and so on. Similarly, with regard to Pakistan, the country that worries me the most in the world today in some ways is Pakistan. And yet the European involvement in Pakistan is minimal, politically somewhat, economically a bit, militarily none. And yet this may be the greatest area of uncertainty and worry in terms of international terrorism on a global basis. So I'd be curious, interested in any comments on this.
Great. And then we have actually a representative from an NGO here, Brian from Mercy Corps. We'll give you the chance for a quick question.
Thanks. I'm Brian Jolkovsky from Mercy Corps. And yes, we're one of those humanitarian actors who are very active in the south of Afghanistan and Helmand and Kandahar, as well as places like Iraq. I don't want to take it back to Afghanistan, although I appreciate the observations by General Nauman and Lord Inge about the challenges that NATO and the West are facing in Afghanistan, because they are a litany. It doesn't take long being on the ground to see the complexity and the challenges that ISAF, NATO, and the various militaries, let alone the civilian actors, are having there. But it raises the basic question for me. I agree with your strategy and proposal of needing to reform NATO and the way the West is approaching. My question still is kind of how. And maybe it's a little bit of an unfair question, but your reform, your grand reform and strategy is predicated on the acceptance of NATO members to give up those national prerogatives that they have held so dear and give up things like caveats in places like Afghanistan. The question is, how do you get there? And do you have some practical suggestions about how you start to overcome those on the way to your grand strategy?
And last question in this round, Erwin, I'm going to give you the last word there.
Good morning. Erwin Nagadek from the Center on Transatlantic Relations. I'm a colleague of STARS. My question goes most directly to Amiral Langsad. Now, to go back to the point, who shall lead? I'm not sure that this was timed, especially looking at the timing of the French presidency of the EU. But surely there is an opportunity there, and I've been involved myself in Brussels in the preparation for the presidency, and we all know the high hopes, some would say over-ambitious hopes, that they are putting into this. At the same time, we see that their thinking isn't necessarily entirely mature, but that, in a sense, that's also a chance, that their thinking is fluid. We see Sarkozy's calling for these wise men groups thinking through the issue, so there's a chance to really use this a window of opportunity to put in new thought and try to see where they can take it. So my question to the Admiral is, I understand you were at the embassy yesterday. I mean, are you going to try and submit the report to President Sarkozy, Minister Kouchner, Jouyet, Morin, and what is the feedback that you're getting, and what are your hopes in terms of the presidency?
Very good questions. I think I'm going to divide these questions as follows. The Admiral, you got the questions straight away, so you answer those questions. Then on the Russia, China, and so on, Klaus. And then the Lord on Pakistan.
The Lord.
And Afghanistan.
The Lord will speak.
What do you think about this? Okay, let's start with Admiral Langsad.
Thank you for the question. I could say that we enter in a new quality of the relationship between France and NATO. And I think that is the central, the core idea of President Sarkozy. I think that will bring change, that will not lead to the conclusion that we asked to re-enter in the integrated military structure. That is not the question. The question is to change the quality of the relationship, and with this idea that the alliance is the place where we have to work between the European and the US. And I think it's a very important question. It's true that we will have the French presidency of the European Union, within 6 months, and I will give. I have already give this report, this pamphlet to the personality you have quoted, Prime Minister, President Sarkozy, and others. And it's up to them to decide what they intend to do. Maybe I could think that if there is a meeting of qualified person looking at the future of Europe, the question of the relationship between the two sides of the Atlantic is one of the questions which has to be addressed.
Thank you, Lord Inch. On Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
I thought it was just Pakistan. if I could deal with Pakistan first, I'm not sure I can give a clear answer to Pakistan. I think I put on the table that it's a major worry, not only to my country, but obviously much more widely. The result of the elections, of course, pretty hugely important. I also think, however, that we need to recognize that the pressure perhaps the West, in inverted commas, put on Musharraf, at times made his position much more vulnerable as a result. And I think we need to think through sometimes. It's because I think we haven't thought through the whole consequences of what might happen if we invaded Pakistan that we're in now in some of the trouble. We've lost that knack, I think, of thinking through both from a historical perspective and what I call the what-if perspective of when you go into a country, what the consequences might be. We made the mistake in Iraq, and I think we've done it in Afghanistan. I'm not saying we shouldn't be in Afghanistan. I'm merely saying I think the detail of the planning for Afghanistan raises big question marks. If Musharraf goes, I think all the options are open. But one thing I'm absolutely clear on, even if they have an elections, you will not have a democracy in the sense that we understand democracy. You may have, with a big question mark, a more stable government. But the problems of the tribal areas of Balochistan, Waziristan, etc., will remain with us. And I think that's the point I made earlier, that the question mark over Afghanistan still remains, I believe, a very large one. Iraq, thank you very much. I actually think we're beginning to make progress in Iraq. I mean, I know there's been some criticisms about the British withdrawal from Basra, but in fact, if you look at it, Basra is much more stable. General Moen in the south has a grip of the situation. The amount of activity by Iran in the south has reduced. Now, whether that is the sort of government or that we would like here in the West remains a question mark. But I believe, actually, that Basra at the moment is looking good. And what is General Petraeus has achieved in the north, I think, with the surge, is remarkable and deserves personally great credit. So there is some progress in Iraq, but again, I think we have to recognize we're going to have to be there in some form and things could go wrong again. But it is looking better, is what I would say.
Klaus?
Well, on this question, India, Russia, and China, first of all, let me say I firmly believe in the truism that there is nothing such as friendship between nations, but there are interests between nations. And to identify the common ground of interest between India, China, and Russia may be a task which might be much more demanding than anything we did in this paper. I cannot see too much of a common ground since we do not threaten these three countries. We have no claims whatsoever. The entire idea we are proposing here is protective and means we want to live in peace with them. And concerning Russia, we argue in this paper for a continuation and a revitalization of the dialogue with Russia. So we could think of new ways of cooperation with Russia. And I should also remind you, it was not the West, if I may use this outdated connotation, it was not the West who used aggressive language against Russia. We not always got it right in dealing with Russia. I fully agree with you. But on the other hand, it was Mr. Putin who used pretty aggressive language at the Munich conference last year. And I still wonder if I may address our media representatives here, why nobody really picked up with a little bit of concern the pretty aggressive statements of the Russian Chief of General Staff when he threatened other countries by using missiles. Imagine for a moment if any one of the Western Chiefs of General Staff had made a similar statement. I would be rather surprised if not a storm would have broken out. But this gentleman can threaten countries and nothing happens. It's also forgotten that, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not aware of all black programs in the United States, obviously not, but I do not know of any new offensive weapon system such as a Topol missile, which is under production and in deployment in Russia. Why don't we mention this? So I think Russia had its share as well in the present situation, which we need to overcome. Let me be clear about this. We need to overcome this, and we need to reopen dialogue. And I'm among those people who were involved in this dialogue for since 1998. I definitely do not know Russia as well as my friend John Shelley. But my experience tells me if you deal with Russians by simply caving in and giving in to every statement they are making, you will soon lose every possibility to influence them. So I think we have to talk to them. We have to tell them that it is our common interest to live together in peace and in cooperation. And last point which I would like to make, if I were in Russia and looked around who can help me in the situation. Russia is not in a position of strength, as Mr. Putin believes. Russia is in a situation which, if you look at all the domestic issues, I would rather call a situation of weakness, of strategic weakness. If he looks around who can help him, okay, good luck if he finds help in China and in India. He may arrange for strategic partnership documents, but these documents are not much more worth than the paper on which they are written. But the issue is, who will help Russia to rebuild their gas production, which will run into difficulties, into terrible difficulties in 2011? The only countries who can do it are the so-called Western countries. So we have a common interest to work together to find a peaceful solution. And we will do this. If we look at each other with mutual respect and take into account the dignity which should govern the international relationship. Thank you.
Admiral Unside, were you going to say? No. Well, we were going to just complete our tour de table in good NATO fashion, but as we had said earlier, the one person we had not yet heard from on the panel was General Shelly Kashvili. So let me turn the floor over to General John Shelly Kashvili at this point for at least a final word from the gang.
I thought this was a very worthwhile discussion, but it also highlighted that there's some more work to be done, which I hope will have in a gang of five will find enough of an interest to work those points with your help, because we ought to not allow this discussion to be the last word on the specific sphere of alliance and partnership.
Thank you. General, thank you so much. Thank you for that great benediction. But I will give Robert Hunter, our former permanent representative, one last word as well.
Let me just echo what John Shelley said. This is not the end. This is the beginning. The marker laid down by these five gentlemen is something that they will, I hope, continue to carry on with, and that the rest of us have to carry on with, against a background that there are a lot of practical things that have to be done immediately and got right. And one of, I think, things that I believe the great value of what these five have done, four of whom are Europeans, it is not at all clear that the United States under a new administration is going to want to focus on NATO and to use NATO for a lot of major strategic issues in the world. We will have an agenda that includes Afghanistan and Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, which has been underscored, the future of Russia, the future of China, the future of Korea, the future of India, a lot of which we will not share a particular perspective or even ambition with a lot of our European allies. Certainly in military terms, I think that's going to be true. The great challenge is to get that right where we can get it right while focusing on the broad international challenges where what we and the Europeans plus the Japanese and a few others do is absolutely central if we're going to get them right. And also reaching out to the newer countries like China and India. But this is a core capacity as represented by what they've said today and by these five gentlemen. I'll just end with what I wish we could do in terms of changing the law. In the United States, or in terms of rank, these are all four-star generals and admirals. Under U.S. law, a five-star, when we had them, was never allowed to retire. I would like to recall all five of these to the colors and put them in charge, because we have heard today, I think, the wisdom of the future and the practical requirement for all of us to build on. Thank you.
Well, again, just quickly in closing, thank you all for joining us today. Thanks to the gang, as Robert said so well, who rather than spending time doting on grandchildren and polishing their golf games, have filled a void that was lacking, providing some food for thought in the development of a grand strategy for the transatlantic relationship. And without any commission, they have formed themselves into a wise man's group or perhaps a new Harmel report, or at least the components of some ideas for further adapting the transatlantic relationship. I want to thank also the Paul Bahn and the Nauber Foundation for their support of this work and for bringing the gang here with to be with us. And lastly, I just want to thank all of my colleagues here, particularly in the Europe program, Julianne Smith and Natalia Filipiak and her colleagues. When Klaus Naumann called us this summer and approached Dr. Hamre and suggested that we might do this, that the gang was coming together with some ideas, it only took us a nanosecond to say yes, because first of all, and as a relative newcomer here to CSIS wants to continue and will continue to remain an important hub in the discussion and the advancement of transatlantic dialogue. And under Julie's leadership, the Europe program has continued to play that role, and I was very happy to join her in supporting this. And again, we thank all of our colleagues here, particularly some number of the next generation folks who are the future of the alliance in the back, Hilly Levitt and Cassandra Smith and others who helped us pull this event off. And we thank you for your patience, and we look forward to continuing the discussion. Thank you all.